22 hours before this morning's meeting that we were not going to be on the floor early, so there was an opportunity to work some bills that, on a 48-hour notice. So we'll start out going through the bills in the order in which they're posted here for work session, and but may take them out of order as things evolve here. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 244.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 244 comes at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. It deletes sunset provision to ORS 138 relating to convicted persons' ability to request DNA testing of evidence. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you also have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which are relate to DNA but are different from the bill, and this relates to the use of DNA in certain circumstances set forth in Sections 5 and 6. Jack Dempsey is here with Brian Barringer and Gwen Dayton, and I think it would be appropriate if they came forward, or at least one of them came forward and explained the amendment to the committee, because it is different than the bill.
I'll invite as many of you as it seems useful to the presentation.
Members of the committee, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Thank you for letting us explain the amendments to Senate Bill 244 this morning. I should indicate that I'm actually here today as a member of the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research, rather than a representative of the Hospital Association. I also have written testimony that, that strangely has not appeared, and I apologize for that, but it will we will be able to provide you some written explanation as well as oral explanation for our changes. The amendments to 244 allow, basically bring genetic information under the same protections from disclosure as all other information is subject to under the HIPAA privacy regulations. You all probably remember from many conversations, I believe, in this committee and elsewhere, that the HIPAA privacy regulations are a federal law that establish a floor for privacy of what's called protected health information, which is essentially your health information. This bill allows HIPAA to protect disclosure of genetic information rather than the current provisions in Oregon law, which require authorization for virtually all purposes. This bill would allow disclosure of genetic information, and we'll talk about what that is, for purposes of treatment of the patient from provider to provider for treatment purposes, for billing. Essentially, the provider, the hospital, medical clinic, whatever, is allowed to bill the insurer, and for what's called healthcare operations. And healthcare operations is really internal workings of the hospital or the provider, the medical provider, like quality assurance, utilization review, internal auditing. The bill would allow disclosure of genetic information for those limited purposes without authorization. So you're thinking, well, why can't you just get authorization? Oregon law requires that now. Why do you want to make this change? The reason that the Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee has recommended this change is in part because the breadth of the definition of genetic information. Genetic information is defined to mean information obtained from a genetic test. And genetic test itself is it has a fairly broad breadth. So what you're talking about is not just a genetic test result, but you're talking about information that a physician or other providers may obtain from the test, like diagnosis. A provider that might use a genetic test to diagnose someone, it's that diagnosis and the treatment for that diagnosis would be specially protected. So you almost have an artificial distinction now in Oregon law. If a person is diagnosed through a genetic test with a particular condition, anything about that condition now requires authorization for disclosure for virtually all purposes, including to their other treating providers. Whereas the same condition, if it was diagnosed without the genetic test, would not be subject to these protections. So what we're wanting to do is take genetic information and allow it to be disclosed for these routine purposes without special authorization from the patient. Now, you might also wonder, why can't you just get authorization? Why isn't more privacy better than less? And the problem is that this information looks so much like other information in the medical chart that hospitals, which is my perspective, but I think the same is true of medical clinics, don't even necessarily know that they have specially protected information until the patient is not in their facility any longer, until the patient has left. We find it in our billing departments. All of a sudden, somebody realizes they should have gotten authorization and they can't bill for the services that were provided. Or we find out when the community physician makes a request for the records because now the patient's being seen out at their doctor's office and we didn't get authorization. We can't disclose the information to the community physician. So we have to go track down the patient, try to get their authorization. That's really what has led to this concern. It's really impeding those routine disclosures that the patient expects to occur. The patient wants their physician to get their information. The patient wants their insurer billed for this. And that can't happen now without this authorization. We also believe that HIPAA provides significant protection for this information. HIPAA would not allow disclosure of genetic or any other information to folks like employers, life insurers, others who legitimately patients want to be able to control their disclosure of their records to. HIPAA would allow a patient to restrict the disclosure of any other information if they want to. So if they don't want their genetic information to be disclosed to whoever, they have the right to make that request to the provider. That's true of any information and would certainly be true of genetic information. HIPAA also, the security rules under HIPAA impose very stringent requirements on providers by way of technological and administrative safeguards. So there are extensive safeguards already in place protecting the inappropriate disclosure of this information. And lastly, before I close, this does also apply to insurers because they are a HIPAA-covered entity. They are subject to HIPAA and the protections of medical records and information. But the advisory committee made it very clear in the law that this disclosure of genetic information would not allow it to be genetic information to be applied to underwriting. Because there's legitimate concern about that. We understand that it can't be used for underwriting. All the existing anti-discrimination laws in Oregon remain in place. We already have laws in place that employers can't use this for inappropriate purposes. We already, or can't use it at all. We already have laws in place that insurers can't use it as well. So those all remain in Oregon law. We think this allows disclosure of information patients expect to be disclosed, and we are grateful for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dayton. Any questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dayton, I'm still a little unclear about why this would not be included in the initial authorization that a patient signs in the hospital. And the way that I read this is you can retain a patient's genetic information without their consent for purposes of payment. And that, I think, is a very difficult issue for us to be able to go explain to our constituents why we're letting hospitals retain genetic information without their authorization. So I'd like a little more explanation about why this, first of all, what you're seeking to do isn't included. If it's for payment purposes, why isn't it included in the initial authorizations and consents that a patient already signs?
Chairman, first, Representative Bonamici, billing for services or an authorization to do that is not something that hospitals and providers obtain now. After HIPAA, we don't need authorization to disclose protected health information, which is your health information, for billing purposes. So right now, if you were to go into a hospital, you will sign some consent forms, but they tend to be consent for routine treatment, conditions of admission, but you won't sign an authorization to disclose your information of whatever sort for billing purposes. So we don't have to do that now under HIPAA. We can give information for billing purposes unless it's specially protected by Oregon law. And genetic information currently is specially protected under Oregon law, as are some drug and alcohol records, as are some limited mental health records. Notably, the Department of Human Services changed the HIV rules in January to allow disclosure of an HIV test result for treatment, payment, healthcare operations as well, without authorization. So this suggested change is consistent with that. So that was an answer to two questions. You only answered one. I hope I answered your question clearly.
Thank you.
Ms. Dayton, it would be helpful to me just to have, understand the mechanics of the amendment, the Dash 1 amendments. There are two different sections or chapters of ORS that are being amended, ORS 192, and within parallel amendments, ORS 746. What is the difference between those two chapters?
Thank you, Chairman Person. The first chapter deals is amending the genetic privacy statute, and it deals with providers, healthcare providers. Then there is Section 6, which is a housekeeping amendment. Then there is the next section that amends the insurance code. And the amendments to the insurance code are virtually parallel to the amendments that apply to providers, with the exception of the reference to not including underwriting activities, because we wanted to specially recognize that insurers play that role, and we didn't think, as the advisory committee, they could anyway, but we wanted to make it very clear that they could not use genetic information for underwriting purposes.
Thank you. And am I reading the language in subsection 1 of section 5 and of section 8 correctly? It appears to me that the allowance would be for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations provided by the provider, not necessarily relating to that particular patient. That is, that maybe this isn't a realistic thing, but it just on its face, mm-hmm. It would seem to allow the retention of genetic information that wouldn't necessarily be for treating that patient, but for maybe, I don't know, building a database of knowledge from which then treatment could be provided to the general public that is being served.
Chairman Person, I hear your point. It's important, and you are correct that technically, the disclosures can be for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, not necessarily involving that individual. Practically speaking, that's just not really how it works. There are also separate research rules under HIPAA. So when you start talking about databases and establishing and using somebody's information for research purposes, you're subject to a whole different set of rules that would be restrictive on the use of that information. But I appreciate your making the point.
Okay, and then with respect to subsection 2 of each of those sections, 5 and 8, the disclosure that is in accordance with, and there's a cross-reference in each case to another provision of the same chapter, and I haven't looked those up, but if you could just briefly tell us what that the disclosure protocols would be.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Person. And the first in subsection 2, it says, notwithstanding 192.539 sub 1, that's the section in the genetic privacy rules that would require authorization. A healthcare provider may disclose information, et cetera, in accordance with 192.520 sub 3. That section allows disclosure of protected health information for purposes of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So it picks up, it expressly aligns the disclosure with the disclosures that are allowed for other medical information.
Okay. Any further questions to Ms. Dayton? Then let's hear from Ms. Meyer. We look to you as the guardian of privacy issues, and so we need to hear from you about this proposal.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I actually also serve on the advisory committee on genetic privacy and research. Watch what you happen when you have a bill and you write in a privacy person should serve on a committee, which we did in 99. You then get a full-time job. This area is very dense. It's very difficult, particularly for those of us who are not medical experts, but this issue has been discussed, the Dash 1 amendments before you today, has been discussed in the committee and has been agreed to by all stakeholders in the committee as a narrow provision that as the definition and expansion of genetic information changes and evolves, it is omitting and leaving out the abilities for the medical community to do its daily common practice and services. We've got lots more to work on in that committee. It actually has to be appointed a member from the House and a member of the Senate, and I encourage any of you, if you want to have complicated, philosophical, difficult discussions, please sign up. Part of me is, you know, I'm here in support of the Dash 1s. I'm here not in opposition of the Dash 1s. They do not delete our core bill, Senate Bill 244. I have to say, and Ms. Dayton knows this, this is a complicated area, far more complicated, I believe, than the original bill. And I am happy to have it added with the cautionary that the DNA innocence law is very near and dear to the ACLU and other stakeholders. It will sunset if Senate Bill 244 does not go through. And while we support the addition of the amendments and we have assurances that this will be shepherded fully through both the House and the Senate, and if there's any glitches, it's my hope that we would get back to the original bill if there's a problem, because I don't want to lose our DNA innocence bill in a larger discussion about the privacy laws related to medical and healthcare information and genetics. So hopefully that.
I want to make one more comment.
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, the panel, I remember the very similar language from last session, and I remember working in this with both of you. We refined it. This appears to be the language. And if I remember correctly, it passed through one chamber and may have died in the other chamber in the dying days of session. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Yes. That's correct.
Okay. Do you have anything further, Ms. Dayton?
If you'll allow me one further comment, I don't want to leave you with a misunderstanding. Chairman Ferson, you asked about creation of databases, and I made a reference to research, which is accurate. But sometimes a hospital can create internal databases, but if they're used only internally for no outside disclosure, they're not trying to arrive at generalizable knowledge, if I can use that term. It's kind of a HIPAA term. Then it would be internal only, wouldn't be research. It would be healthcare operations. And so I just want to make sure that I didn't mislead you. There could be the use of genetic information inside a hospital by a provider that's maybe looking at conditions or something like that, but not publishing anything, just looking at it for their own internal purposes. That could be termed healthcare operations. I just didn't want to mislead.
I appreciate that clarification, and there are conflicting and important policies, and privacy is an important policy and value in our society, but the advancement of medical knowledge is as well, because we all collectively benefit from that. So we want to see it through the right balance struck between those.
Chair McPherson, I think, you know, what we have is a dynamic both with HIPAA coming into play. We have the genetic privacy, the exceptionalism, sort of treating genetic information, and we, ACLU, supports that in Oregon law. And then you had the merging of HIPAA on that, and there's just been a whole dynamic of interplay. I think we do have the safeguards of HIPAA in place, which, when this was originally contemplated and passed, we didn't have that safeguard. So we didn't have a floor that was floorless, and so we have that, and we think, hopefully, the sufficient privacy protections. But ACLU has no problem urging you to move forward with the caveats I've already said. But you can clearly see this is a complicated area, an area that, as technology and the definition of what genetic information evolves, will need to be revisited time and time again before you, so that we can continue to have the sufficient privacy protections that certainly my organization believes is critical.
Very good. If there are no further questions, we are in work session now on Senate Bill 244, and we have the Dash 1 amendments, which are the amendments that Ms. Dayton, Ms. Dayton just presented to us, and I would invite a motion then on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 244.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 244. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 244 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 244 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Aye.
Representative Moore?
Aye.
Representative
Aye. Representative Aye. Senate Bill 244 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And is it somebody who's particularly interested in carrying this bill? Representative Cameron, thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair, I'll carry it. And the reason I'll carry it is I think I'm supposed to be on this genetic task force, but I've never been there, so I'll do them a favor and I'll carry the bill
connection
today.
There. That's terrific. Thank you, Representative. Okay. I'm going to now, because of the schedules of some people who are in the room, I'm going to go forward to an open work session on Senate Bill 257. Council Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 257
just to remind the committee, is the bill that would classify variable annuities as securities for the purposes of the Oregon Securities Act.
Committee members, we've had two hearings on this bill and heard fairly extensively both from proponents and opponents. And unlike the most of the products that are coming over to us from the Senate, which are consensus products, this is not. So I had carried it over to a separate day work session, but it's now before us. We have there are no amendments here now, so we have the bill as passed by the Senate. We have the witnesses who appeared in the public hearing in the room if there were a need for more input, if you needed to be reminded of factual background or any further information. But those are available. I just throw it open for discussion or a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
I just wanted to raise some issues that were sent to us yesterday via email by Mr. Banks, who was here for the first public hearing. He was here for the second, but didn't get a chance to testify. And he was sent us all an email, and I know how we get hundreds of emails, so I don't know if everybody received this, but I just wanted to let people know that he wrote and said that some statements were made suggesting that variable annuities are not a significant problem. As someone who hears from investors regularly and who monitors investment abuse trends nationwide is an important part of my job, I know that's not the case. And he attached some data that he has sent about other enforcement efforts and talked about how the it's the NASAA, which I understand is the North American Securities Administrators Association, is encouraging, the NASAA is encouraging changes in state laws that would allow state insurance regulators to continue to oversee the companies that sell variable annuities while authorizing state securities regulators to investigate complaints about variable annuities and to take action against the companies and individuals who sell them. State securities regulators look not only at the sales practices of selling variable annuities, as well as the licensing and registration of the product. So he did send some additional information encouraging and supporting passage of this bill.
Very good. Representative Krieger, did you?
Do you recall, Mr. Chair, the number of complaints? I can't remember that figure.
I've got it. I have, in 5 years, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, 5 years, 60 complaints. And then I asked a question at the end and got the answer off the record of 40,000 policies.
My point there, Mr. Chair, is 40,000 policies, that many complaints. I'd like to know how many complaints there have been on the last 40,000 cases that attorneys have been involved in. There's probably 10 times that many complaints on bar members. About the last 40,000 arrests by state police officers, I'm willing to bet you that there's more than that many complaints. So it isn't an extraordinary number. It may have an extraordinary effect on certain people's lives because I think maybe the majority of them are older. But I still feel that within the existing system we've got, they're capable of addressing it. And with the new rules that they've got, I think that could have been relieved. I'm not certain there's really a need for the change.
I didn't have the 40,000 number, and I'm wondering whether that matches up with the... That is, that the 60 complaints were on 40,000 sales of separate policies. If that's an important point, we could try to get more information from people who are in the room. But it may not be a critical point. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're in work session. My comments on this bill is, as we had good testimony, and I think the director. I want a strong Department of Consumer and Business Services. But the director commented that this was not on their radar scope. I think it's a bill looking for a problem. I'm not sure the problem justifies the bill. And I would like to get on the record a statement from the director, if this bill is going to pass, that she will not need additional staffing. And if she does, then it needs to go to Ways and Means for Referral.
Well, I think that's probably a fair comment. So why don't we have Ms. Streisinger come forward to help us understand whether this would necessitate additional staffing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And in response to Representative Wisnett's question, we do not anticipate that it would need additional staffing. We already are doing examinations of the broker-dealers the additional supervision requirements would apply to. We have an enforcement staff. We prioritize cases based on the severity of the issues, and we would continue to do so.
Very good. Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, since we have the director here, you did comment that this was not on your radar scope, that you had other issues, you know, as far as legislative action. So it was not a, if I understood that to mean that it, you know, your job is to look after me and my fellow consumers, and so you had other priorities that for your agency than this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, thank you. And I would actually like to clarify, this particular bill is not one that we advanced. The issue of variable annuities is and has been on our radar scope. And as I think Representative Krieger mentioned, we have been focusing on this area through the authority that we currently have in the insurance side. We've put in place additional suitability rules. And we definitely do feel that the issue of inappropriate sales of variable annuities is an issue that we do focus on. This particular issue of adding variable annuities to the securities laws is not one that we had brought forward, but I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that we don't think the sale of variable annuities is an issue or a problem.
Go ahead. Thank you for that, those comments. I've been proud of this committee and the chairman's leadership in that we've tried to get consensus, so there was no meeting or try to consensus between the affected business and your agency in trying to reach compromise to see if it could be done. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we have not had extensive discussions with the industry. There was not extensive testimony on the Senate side, and actually until we got over to the House side, I wasn't aware of the depth of emotion, if you will, that the industry was putting into this issue.
Okay. Final question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think it's important, again, as a consumer and our fellow consumers, that would you agree that there is a lot of regulation and other ways of this activity, however?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, there certainly it is a regulated sale and a regulated activity. The issue for us really in this bill is not the substantive standard, but rather in the enforcement tools.
Thank you.
Ms. Streisinger, what I was asking counsel to remind me about, maybe you can help me out on this, is that I think there was some work done on this bill on the Senate side to narrow its scope, that there was a class of product that was going to be included under the bill as originally introduced and that was then carved out by amendment. Do you have information on that?
Mr. Chair, as I recall, some of the language would have included variable life insurance policies, which are a different product, which weren't intended to be covered by the scope of this bill. So the language was narrowed to exclude.
So committee, our situation is the bill has been worked. It hasn't been worked to a consensus point, but it has been adjusted in response to comments from the industry.
I just have one more comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
These variable annuities are marketed as securities. They're really not, even though they're, as the Director Streisinger said, they're in an insurance wrapper. They're being sold as securities. They're being sold as an investment. And since they're already considered securities under the federal law, it just, to me, makes most sense to have them regulated as securities under state law and use the tools that the DCBS has to regulate securities, if that's, in fact, what they're being marketed as and sold as and purchased as.
Representative Flores.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I would just reference the information, particularly from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, which does define these variable annuities as insurance policies. And, yes, there are securities components, but that is not its primary definition by numerous venues. And as Ms. Reisinger just said, she said this issue is not the substantive standard, but the enforcement tools. And again, she indicated that there was already a regulatory component to the sales of variable annuities. Consequently, I will be voting no on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? And do I hear a motion? Representative Kump.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 257A as, well, we didn't
we,
make
we
any
did
amendments.
We did not amend it. Yeah.
I'm so used to putting amendments on it, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kump moves Senate Bill 257A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of that motion?
I just wanted to make one comment, Mr. Chair. What concerned me is the testimony by the opponents, and that was the fact that they showed three different distinctive styles of product. There was a pamphlet, that, or two-page something that did mutual funds, and something else was in a pamphlet. When I saw the depth of the text of what this would be like, and I don't, anything that has that much depth and pages too, it looks just about as bad as a No Child Left Behind Act pages. And so I think scrutiny is a good thing, and we are here to protect our consumers.
Thank you, Representative. I'd like to offer a comment, committee, which is that the variable annuity product is a valuable and useful product. It is, it combines the elements of insurance so people can be guaranteed a lifetime income with the variability that you get in the stock market, that is the opportunity to get the swings of investment return, and that's a very useful combination. But it's useful because it introduces an investment component so that it really isn't purely insurance. It is a hybrid in my mind. It has elements of insurance appropriately regulated under insurance, but it also has elements of investment, and the remedies that are associated with the securities regulations seem appropriate to me in that setting. And happily, in Oregon, the same people at DCBS administer both, so it's not as though we're bringing a whole separate set of regulators into the process. So that seems to me a useful way to go, to give some additional tools for our securities and insurance regulators to be able to look at this line of product, where in those few cases, and they are few, where there is misuse of the product I'm convinced it's over-enthusiasm on the part of some of the sales force is probably what brings this about. But I think to have DCBS with the opportunity to scrutinize that kind of conduct most effectively is a useful thing. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we also heard that anyone who was in the business of selling variable annuities, there were sanctions within the industry itself where someone who was found to have committed some level of fraud or malpractice, they lose their job, the business is scrutinized. I think there are many tiers of sanctions already that are in place by the industry itself. So I, once again, will just reaffirm I will not be supporting this bill.
Any further discussion? If hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 257A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, serve notice if possible on our report.
Very good. So noted for the record, and the chair will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 257A and open a work session on Senate Bill 629. Council Taylor.
Committee, you had before you Senate Bill 269 establishes that money judgments against incarcerated persons do not accrue until person is out of custody, establishes that once person is released from custody, interest accrues at 9%, annually declares an emergency in the act effective upon passage, effective July 1, 2007. You may remember at the last time this bill was before you, there was a discussion of concerning another bill that we passed out, House Bill 2311, which basically stays the running of interest after 20 years. And what you have being passed out to you is the amendment that will be proposed to
House Bill 2311 that Darren Stanford worked with Legislative Counsel's Office to put together to make the two of them compatible. It took a little bit of finessing on because of relating clause issues as it relates to another statute. But basically, you'll see on lines 10 through lines 18 for 2311 the amendment that when a person is sentenced to a term of imprisonment, interest on a judgment of criminal action does not begin to accrue until the first day of the second full calendar month after the person's initial release from custody following the sentencing in which the monetary obligation was imposed. And if the judgment includes a money award for restitution, a judgment accrues for a period of 20 years after the first day of the second full calendar month after the person's initial release from custody following the sentencing in which the monetary obligation was imposed. So, for example, if the person had a monetary obligation, spent 10 years in prison, when they came out at the end of 10 years, interest would start to accrue from that date and would run for 20 years. It wouldn't be starting from the day of judgment. And so, for example, if the person did 19 years and came out and would only get 1 year of interest, that's not the case. It would go for another 20 years from that date.
And committee members, I did have a conversation with Fred Boss from the Department of Justice just to make sure that this was consistent with what the department has been trying to do in managing restitution generally, and he has indicated, as he's nodding to indicate, to reaffirm that this is approach of having the interest not run during incarceration but then starts to run for a full 20 years is consistent with the way they've approached that issue.
Mr. Chair, how did Mr. Boss talk to the Crime Victims United because they were a player in 2311?
I don't know that we heard from Crime Victims United, and Mr. Boss, you imagine you're asked to speak for somebody else who's not in the room, and so very good. I don't think we have that input, although what I would say is that 629, what it does is simply extends the start of the calculation of interest, and it was the other bill, 2311, that dealt with the calculation of interest itself, and it was in that setting where we shortened the we changed the interest rate to reflect that 20-year cutoff.
The thing I remember about 2311 though is you started paying principal first, and so that principal all went to the victim. That's not affected by this.
Council.
Chair members of the committee, we had extensive hearings in 2311 here and also in the Senate. I can go back and check my files, but I don't remember Crime Victims United weighing in on the bill one way or the other. Okay. And it's been up a lot, but I
said they did.
I can go out and check my files. So.
Council, would this amendment to 2311 change that aspect of 2311?
Chairman of the Committee, Representative Bonamici, as it relates to principal first, no. This simply does, it says, okay, for the 20-year period, if you're in prison, it tolls the statute of limitations, probably the best way, similar to what you have in certain civil actions.
I think it meshes all right because the principal first change that was made by 2311 isn't affected by when interest runs. It just means that any amount is paid, it's going to be applied to principal first. And as a result of Senate Bill 629, then no interest accrues until incarceration ends and then starts to accrue and accrues for 20 years and no longer. Assuming it's, of course, if it's paid sooner, it would accrue only as long as until the obligation's paid.
So this amendment did not change. This starts, but it talks about we're starting at line 12, 14, so I guess. No, sir, no, Mr. Chair, in the amendment to 2311. See, I'm wondering what's
this
left
amendment
in.
This doesn't fit that bill.
Right,
so we're deleting 1214. Yeah. I don't know what we deleted in 1214.
We don't have our bill files.
As you know, this relates to a different bill. I mean, I can go get your copies of the bill. Remember, if they adopt this amendment, it has to come back to the Senate for concurrence. Oh, excuse me. But
to come back to us.
The idea would be
this will come back.
We would move Senate Bill 629 the way it came over to us. We would have proposed that House Bill 2311 be amended to conform with the choice we're making, the decision we're making in 629, and of course the Senate would need to do that. We'd have to rely on the assurance that they will act, so they don't just go ahead and move 2311 the way it was, and 60, if we move 629 the way it does.
And this comes back to the House for vote?
Well, actually, only if it's an amended for concurrence.
Okay.
So we there is a little bit of a leap of faith here that in order to feel comfortable with 629, I have to say, I would have to see that 20-year period would run, that we wouldn't want to be cutting it short by the period of incarceration. And I rely on the good faith of our, and the logic, I think, of that policy choice. I mean, I think anybody who thinks about that would say, yeah, that's the way it ought to work. Nobody would seriously argue that a person who is incarcerated for most of the 20 years should thereby avoid nearly all the interest.
I don't think we disagree with that. Just to be sure that the intent of 2311 wasn't changed by this.
Well, our only remedy in that would be to hold up on 629 until 2311 was worked on the Senate side to make this amendment. And we could do that. I mean, we still have another 12 days before the end of the month.
Does staff know when that bill is due, Mr. Chair? Has it been scheduled over there?
Sure. Well, committee, I believe it's scheduled next Tuesday.
Well, we could roll over.
Wait.
Okay, I think that's sound. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 629A, and we'll be re-noticing that for after next Tuesday, so that we can know that was acted on.
Mr. Chair, just a procedural question: is there someone going to advocate for the -4 amendments in the Senate on the Senate side? Do we need to? You'll be there and. I just want to make sure that if they don't go through
Chair,
Tuesday without
Von
Michi, somebody advocating.
You may remember on the this 629 was sponsored by Senator Walker. Senator Walker serves on Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right.
She's well aware of the amendments. Darren Stanford worked these amendments out with her. So my assumption is that she would be the advocate for the amendments, as would staff. And
thank you.
I think that should be enough. But
just wanted to make sure that
sure.
Was
yeah, I can appreciate
not
that because
the credit. Thank you.
Okay, so I will close the work session on Senate Bill 629 and open a work session on Senate Bill 597.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 597 comes in from Senator Brown, allows birth relatives as well as birth parents to enter into a contract with adopted parents for the purposes of continued contact with the adopted child. You have the -3 amendments in front of you, which modified somewhat, allows an adoptive parent and birth relative with emotional ties to a child to enter into a written agreement for continued contact between the child and the birth relatives when the child is subject to an adoption proceedings in a dependency matter. Requires the consent of the child if the child is 14 years of age or older. Allows a court to show approval of agreement for continued contact by incorporating the agreement by reference and indicating the court's approval of the agreement in the adoption judgment. Maura Gross from Senator Brown's office is here. I know the last time we were going to try to contact a lawyer in Portland, Mark Kramer, by speakerphone. I see we have the speakerphone, but I don't necessarily have his phone number.
I don't either, so maybe...
it's right here.
Oh, okay.
On the testimony that is in.
We do have it here.
Mr. Chair, is there any problems with the bill?
Not that I'm aware of, although, as you may recall, we opened, I think, and closed the public hearing without really receiving any input on it, so I think this is really our first kind of penetration into it.
Chair, members of the committee, after the last quick hearing, we did meet in the hall with DHS and Maura Gross, and DHS had some concerns, but I believe that the language has been worked out to their satisfaction, and that all interested parties on this bill and the amendment are compatible, should we say.
Well, committee, I guess the
one question is it says allows birth relatives as well as, do they both have to agree before it goes forward? Or could one of them not enter an agreement because they didn't want to?
Members of the committee, Representative Krieger, my assumption on any agreement is that both parties have to agree. That's the nature of an agreement. I'm sure the DHS could come up and elaborate on that, but I can never imagine an agreement where parties didn't agree.
Well, but I think that the issue that Representative Krieger is raising is that the birth parents are two different individuals, and what if one agrees and the other doesn't? And that might be a very common enough situation in which there's an adoption.
You've got these conflicts, and sometimes vindictive people try to use the children, and I wouldn't want them to be able to do that.
Chairman of the committee, if a child within the jurisdiction of juvenile court and an adopted, it says in the singular, and an adopted parent and a birth relative may enter, and I'm reading that as in the singular, so it would have to be an agreement as it relates to those particular individuals. If you have more than one relative, it would seem to me that each relative would have to enter into an agreement with the adoptive parent. If there were more than two adopted, the husband and wife adopting, they'd both have to enter an agreement, which would make sense. I mean, if the wife said yes and the husband said yes and the wife said no, it would be probably an untenable situation.
And of course, birth relative isn't limited to parents. It's grandparents, sibling, or other member of the child's birth family.
Mr. Chair, just from some personal experience, I'm aware of this, that in a situation where a birth mom gives up her child for adoption, the parents, the adoptive parents, agreed. They don't have to, and obviously the birth mom doesn't have to go along with that adoption either, but the parents agreed to allow her to be involved in that child's life. But it does not allow for the relatives, and so what I understand this law to do is allow those relatives to enter into that agreement, but it would still be controlled by the people who are doing that adoption and saying, no, if we want to adopt a kid and cut off all ties, then they're going to have to go someplace else. I think that's just allows that to take place.
Representative Cameron's correct. As you'll see in lines 5 through 11, which is coming out, it's between a birth parent and the adopted parents. So that's correct. It broadens it out. So, for example, the grandparents could still stay involved. Mm-hmm. Would have the right to contract with it, right. And that contract would be recognized.
I think,
by law.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I think Representative Krieger has brought up a good point in that it's may enter into, and I think the cases we hear in the press and in our districts is where grandparents want to be able to visit and are not allowed to visit. Mm-hmm. And you know, I understand if the court says that's not a safe environment, the grandparents are not good, but it seems like.
But there was a U.S. Supreme on that decision on grandparents that came up.
That they can enter into it?
They cannot, but it's up to the parents. The parents don't want them in. I mean,
really?
I guess, committee, the procedural question is, what input do we need? We're kind of trying to sort it out and parse it on our own, and we do have some resources in the room and available by telephone. Would it make sense to get those connected so that we can try to inform our discussion here?
I mean, I'm comfortable with what counsel's explained it in answer to Representative Krieger's good questions. Okay. I'm ready to move.
Okay. Well, then it appears that people are comfortable enough with it now. And as I understand it, the dash threes then supersede the prior dash ones and dash twos, counsel.
Right.
So
I have a question.
Representative Bonamici.
And the amendment in new paragraph 2. I read that as being any adoptive parent and birth parent, but then in paragraph 3, it's for a child that's within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, or
that's
is
correct.
All of this fitting into that's some other statutory scheme that limits when this can be used?
Chair members of the committee, Representative Bonamici, I believe the intent in subsection 3 and the plain meaning of the language is it's limiting just to dependency matters. Well, in subsection 2, it's a parent or birth parent may enter into a written agreement approved by the court permitting continued contact between the birth relatives and the child or adoptive parents. Adoptions can be through dependency court. They can be through other than chapter 419B.
So then my follow-up question is that then is the second part of paragraph 3 on the first page of the dash 3 amendment that has to do with the child under 1 year of age, does that only apply to children within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, or does that also apply to the adoptions that are within paragraph 2?
Chair members of the committee, the way I read that, it applies solely to paragraph 3.
It's not a comma or a semicolon.
That's what I mean. I guess the same thing would be true with the established emotional ties. Only within
correct.
Paragraph 3. I think maybe we want clarification about whether that was the intent.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I'd suggest Samara Gross come up and DHS, because I believe this is some of the things that they worked out in the amendment to make it
Let's do here just a little bit more here and make sure that we're getting forming the best understanding here.
And can I clarify my concern? Is that the established emotional ties and the ongoing personal relationship only seem to go within the child who's in the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and not to the other subsections?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, my name is Mara Gross. I am Senator Kate Brown's legislative aide, and I have worked with the Department of Human Services as well as Mark Kramer, the advocate on this bill. Representative Bonamici, in response to your question, yes, the intent was that only to apply to non-parent relatives. The amendment that had the limitation for non-parent relatives was significantly in response to a concern from Representative Gelser, who is an adoptive parent, and she was concerned that if it applied to all relatives, including infants, that could put pressure on young birth parents, it could put pressure on adoptive parents, and really we wanted to address the situation for kids in the dependency system where they may already have ongoing relationships with grandparents. Maybe they've been living with the grandparents, for example, but for various reasons are unable to adopt. These kids have these relationships with these family members, want this continuity, and want to have a way for those other relatives to enter into an agreement and enforce it.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee?
Let me.
Representative Wisner.
I'm having problems now with what you're saying. You changed paragraph 2 to take out the right to have emotional ties with any family members. If it's an adoption, I don't understand. I'm well aware of a program called Family Bind where the success of a child depends upon how many connections it has to people that care and have connections and love for this individual. And it seems like what you just told me, you're cutting that off in paragraph 2, intentionally.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnant, I don't believe that the intention is to cut that off. It's for family members who do have those relationships with the children. Unless I'm misunderstanding your question.
Mr.
Maybe
Chair.
Someone DHS
I kind of saw the light here when I because paragraph 2 allows the agreement between the adoptive parent and the birth parent, but paragraph 3 is expanding it to an adoptive parent and a birth relative. Mm-hmm. And so when you bring that, it's not a parent in section 3, so that's when you have to show the established emotional ties and ongoing personal relationship. It's probably presumed that a birth parent has at least some emotional tie in within paragraph 2.
Chairman of the committee, if I could probably address this question when the Gus and Department of Justice. The way I'm reading this is section 2 applies to all adoptions.
Yes.
Section 3 applies to dependency matters, if I'm correct. Section 4 would apply to all provisions in this section, which means it would apply to sections 2 and 3. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes.
Yes.
And if I'm also reading Section 2, it's similar to the current subsection 2 that's being removed. So as it relates to all adoptions other than in dependency matters, we're not changing anything policy-wise.
Chair McPherson, Council Taylor, actually the changes that the amendments propose to the statute expand the authority of a birth relative to enter into an agreement with an adoptive parent. Under the current statute, contact between a birth relative and an adoptive parent may only occur if the birth parent agrees. So as it currently stands, the birth parent must agree with the adoptive parent to allow the birth relative to have contact. for the record, my name is Linda Guss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I apologize. And I'm here at the request of the Department of Human Services simply to answer questions. So actually, Section 2 simply says that the adoptive parent and the birth parent can continue, as they have under current law, to enter into a post-adoption communication agreement. Section 3 says that now a birth relative can independently enter into a post-adoption communication agreement with an adoptive parent, but that opportunity is only available in a dependency case.
Any further questions? Well, committee, we have the -3 amendments before us, and I think I understand the choices that are being made here now, that the difference between Section 2 and Section 3, which are quite different, but Section 2 is a much is limited only to adoptive parent and birth parent, whereas it's a broader scope but with a restricted standard in the Section 3.
Mr. Chair, could Representative Barker expand? He says the Supreme is in our council. The Supreme Court has said the grandparents do not have.
There was a case out of Washington where, I don't remember which, but let's just say the father dies, and so then the woman remarries, the widow remarries, and father's parents want to be involved. And at some point, they annoy the new parents, and they say, "You can't come around anymore." So they sued and said, "This is our grandchild. We should have rights." The Supreme Court said parents get to decide who has contact, and they excluded the grandparents from that.
Wow.
I wish you'd asked that sooner. I just wrote out this whole thing to hand to you, but
So then back to paragraph 2, we could put in there that it's expand 2 beyond birth parent. Would be an option because it still says may.
Well, I guess the question is what's the significance of or the effect of Section 2? My assumption about it, I need to get response from the panel, is that without this provision that allows a contract, that there's nothing binding on the parties to enter into an if they enter into an agreement, there's nothing to allow them to enforce the contract or the agreement. That is that sort of standard contract law is there has to be consideration going both directions for it to become a binding promise, and that if you didn't have this provision making recognizing such a contract, that even if there was an agreement that they entered into, then it would not be binding because there'd be no consideration. Is that a fair kind of reaction?
Representative McPherson, I think if you look at Section 2 of the amendment as simply continuing what is currently in the law, and what Section 3 does is simply break out of current law what was an opportunity for a birth parent and an adoptive parent to allow a birth relative to have contact. And instead, under this, it actually gives the birth relative an independent opportunity to have an agreement with the adoptive parent. So even if the birth parent and the adoptive parent couldn't come to an agreement, the birth relative and the adoptive parent could agree. And you're right. It is similar to contract law. There are specific enforcement provisions within the remainder of the statute that describe how to enforce or modify these agreements. And again, that would subsection 3 would actually give, I believe, the birth relatives, if they have an agreement, the opportunity to seek enforcement or modification.
And
previously, they were not really a party to the agreement. They were perhaps a beneficiary of the agreement between the parent, birth parent, and the adoptive parent, but they really weren't a party. They may have gotten some contact if everyone agreed, but they weren't really a party to that agreement. I hope that makes some
sense.
I just wanted to make sure that we're addressing Representative Wisnett's suggestion, which is to open up paragraph 2 to birth relatives so that in all adoptions, not just adoptions where the child's under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, but in all adoptions, giving birth relatives the ability to enter into the agreement with the adoptive parent. Is that
yes,
what
ma'am.
You're suggesting?
that because we have the Supreme Court ruling, so it's not a legal responsibility, but under contract it could be a responsibility if they enter into the agreement.
So the suggestion is that if we were to replace parent with relative in line two of the dash three amendments, then that would allow an adoptive parent and a birth relative to enter into an agreement to permit continuing contact between the birth relatives, plural.
That's the way it was in the original.
Yeah.
There have been efforts to try and pass an extension for several sessions, is my understanding. And so we initially had that broader language, and I think I'm not sure where DHS is on that, because I had heard previously that they had concerns with expanding it so broadly, but they can speak to that better. It was really in response to the concern from Representative Gelser that we thought we would start with this more narrow provision for kids in the foster care system, and then potentially expand it if we saw relationships where that aren't getting put under this. But I don't have a sense that Senator Brown would be opposed to an expansion, as you're suggesting.
Thank you. I would, Mr. Chair, as a grandparent, I pray I never have to use this, but I would like to see it expanded.
Okay. Well, committee, we're not right
Mr.
up
Chair.
Against a deadline.
Mr.
Here.
Chair, I'm going to, maybe I'm seeing this wrong, but I, under the way paragraph two is written now, and I'm going to maybe rub the hair on my colleague a little wrong way. If a if an individual, say my daughter has a baby and wants to give it up for adoption, she comes into an adoptive agreement with another party and they don't want me involved in their life, in that child's life, they have the ability under paragraph two to make that adoption and go on, is the way I understand this.
That's
and
correct.
I have no
That's correct.
Rights. My concern is if now we replace with birth parent with birth relative, is that you're going to slow down a lot of adoptions in this state, because there are people that want to adopt babies but want them to be their own and cut the ties. And, you know, it still allows us to have a conversation about it. And I don't know, that'd be my concern of opening it up so broadly. And correct me if I'm wrong, and that might be one of the concerns of opening it up to where you're at. I understand if my daughter doesn't want me to have the adoptive rights to that baby.
But Mr. Chair, it's all permissive. It's all may enter.
It's all, yeah, exactly, between those two people.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, Representative Wisnant, I think that's exactly the reason for narrowing that Representative Gelser was concerned about, was the situation of, if to use an example of a 16-year-old birth mother, and she wants to give up the child for adoption, the adoptive parents want to do that. If you start to introduce other parties into it, there may be a lot of pressure on that young mother from her parents, for example, to enter into those agreements. There could be pressure on the adoptive parents to accept a relationship with lots of family members when these are not existing these are not long-term relationships that have come about, and she was concerned about the pressure and the slowing down of the process. So that's exactly the concern that Representative Gelser raised.
I follow up, if I may, and I know of a situation where the concern that you brought up, where that 16-year-old daughter actually gave up the baby for adoption, but the adoptive parents did allow her and her parents to maintain some sort of relationship out into the future on visitation rights. Now, that was one where they worked that out. So, I mean, there are people that want to do that. I'm concerned about opening it wide up, and then the baby doesn't, you know, gets caught up in this whole big deal. That'd be my concern.
Representative Kump.
Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I frequently do, I agree with my colleague on the left. As a grandparent, as a grandparent and a mother of four daughters, the reality is I've dealt with basically this situation, and I have two grandchildren that are shuffled an incredible amount from loving home to loving home. And the grandparents, maybe I don't necessarily get along with the grandparent of my grandson or my granddaughter, or support their value sometimes, but these two children are the most loved children I've ever seen, and they know it. And they know it because they've had that contact, and our world has changed so dramatically. The recent figure out there, under 50, there's more people that are not married than married. And many of them have children. And some ways the family trees have grown very leafy and broad. But I just would like to see the original bill with Section 2.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I just want to make one note on with the expansion, did go back to the original language, that it would still, under this language, only apply to adoptive situations. So the situation where you have your grandchildren and there's a step family and all of that, it would not address that situation.
Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I'm comfortable with a -3 amendment as is. It's not that I wouldn't consider a broader at some point in the future, but it's a pretty big policy choice to be making. Mm-hmm. And I think it would require at least some testimony and some input from interested groups. At the very least would require not just adding birth relative to that, but also having the emotional tie and ongoing personal relationship, sections. So I'd support the -3 amendments as they are, but keeping in mind that's something we may want to look at, but certainly without more discussion in testimony.
Okay. Committee, I'm reminded of a comment from one of our witnesses earlier about extended philosophical discussions. Maybe setting an example of that ourselves here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I appreciate Senator Brown. I know the intent of what she was trying to do here, but I think by narrowing it down like this, and I respect Representative Gelzer and her situation, but again, I have a videotape, Representative Bonamici, from Family Fine, and I will show you that and how much success a child has, the more connections that child has in its life that loves that child. And I think that overwhelms me to at least put that in. It's still permissive to say that I would. So I, with my colleague on the right,
as we all know,
will not agree with -3 and want to support leaving it broader. And I hope the Senator understands my position.
I think we're kind of getting a sense of where people are. Yes, my sense is that birth relative is defined so broadly that creating this, it would need some restriction on the distance it would go before I would feel comfortable going to an expansion. I mean, if you could, I could see it going beyond birth parent, but I think the language other member of the child's birth family. Yeah, but other members of the child's birth family, does that mean a cousin would have the right to come forward and say, well, he's my cousin, and I want to be able to have an agreement with additional ongoing contact, and that would be broader than I would want to go.
And Mr. Chair, we talked about the loving grandparents, which there are many of, but there's also some scum of the earth
there's
out
some
there
wackles
that are grandparents that you might not want connected.
Well, we could bring it back for another day. We could, because we do have a little time here before the end of the month when it closes down.
Yeah. Or we could. What is the -2 amendment? Could you please refresh us about that?
Chair members of the committee, the -2 amendments were further refined by -3. They, for example, some of us had concerns about using the word has rather than using the word has had, among the technical questions. Chair, member of the committee, if I could ask Linda Gus one question. My understanding, the case that Representative Barker was talking, I think the name just came back to me. That was the Troxel case, was it not, out of Washington?
That's
state
correct.
Of Washington went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, under Troxell, for example, if the parent or the adoptive parent, the parent had the right to control, the court could not dictate who would have a relationship with the child if the parent did not want to do that. Is that correct?
Representative McPherson, Council Taylor, my recollection of Troxell, it's been a little while since I've read it, there's a presumption that a parent is fit and making appropriate decisions for their children. So with fit parents, the courts do not generally have the authority to override their wishes with regard to contact with, in the Troxell case, the grandparents. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, one further question. How would Troxell impact this proposed legislation?
Representative McPherson, Council Taylor, you put me on the spot here. I think that it would not impact it because what this is a permissive authority for essentially two private people to enter into an agreement for some kind of contact after an adoption decree is finalized. That would be my on-the-spot analysis. It doesn't require that an adoptive parent allow any contact by a particular person. It doesn't say grandparents or other relatives have an absolute right to some kind of contact. So I'm not convinced that Troxell, that this bill would be in conflict with the Troxell decision.
Thanks.
If I'm wrong, I'm sure there's someone in the back who will correct me.
Representative Cobb.
Chair McPherson, I would really recommend that we do move the bill forward. I know I have the right, if there's a motion for the amendment, possibly not support the amendment, but we'll support the bill as we move the bill forward. Did I say that right? Anyway, yeah, I think we ought to move it forward, and if I want to do a no vote on the amendment, so be it. And yeah, I'm not willing to hold it up.
Mr. Chair, one more point on the dash three amendments. It does have the established emotional ties and ongoing personal relationship components that aren't in the original bill, and so that I see that as a way to sort of get at some of the maybe the relatives who don't really have that relationship and keep them from contractually trying to have a relationship when they don't have that. So that's another reason why I would support the dash threes. And the dash threes do go beyond what's permitted currently. It is expanding the opportunities, at least in one area. So it is a step forward.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
Just his query, though. Representative Bonamici, the sub three on the dash threes pertains only to those dependency proceedings within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. So
right.
It doesn't go to having established the emotional tie in the other types of adoption proceedings. And I think that's what Representative Wisnett is trying to get to. It doesn't have that same provision.
Right. But that's because that in the other situations, it's only the parent, the birth parent rather than the other relatives.
Yeah. Well, to hear a motion on the dash three amendments, that may be the way to kind of.
I'll move the dash threes.
Representative Barker moves the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 597. Why don't we first any discussion of that motion? Then let's have a roll call vote on the amending 597 with the dash three amendments.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Aye, it's you.
It's just a difficult issue.
It is.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
No.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. So the motion carries and the dash three amendments are in the bill. Any discussion on the amended bill now? Representative Krieger.
This is an extremely difficult thing. It's the type of stuff the dependency work group worked with. We're going to have to come back and monitor for unforeseen things, and there may be a need in the next session to work with DHS to see what they've encountered and the attorneys that represent these people. Maybe we'll have to modify it, but trying to get a perfect product with something this difficult is hard.
Representative Flores.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's kind of what was formulating. There is no provision for a look back on this. I'm just wondering if maybe that's something we should consider.
Like a look back, mean like a sunset, or?
We have that prerogative to go back and do any statute any time, take a look at it.
Well, that's presuming, of course, someone keeps it on their radar and said, oh, I remember we had some concerns about this.
Representative, I think I can see one representative who'll have it on his radar. But
your question is, how long is I'm going to be here and how long are you going to be here? But I think there are people in the community that will replace us that are young gentlemen like him that will be here another 100 years.
A life sentence, Representative.
They can continue this and monitor it, and they're going to learn about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we have testimony from somebody who's a family law attorney, and I'm sure that the people who are involved in this field doing adoptions will keep an eye on it, and DHS as well. Certainly, I know Representative Wisnett will continue the conversation about expanding this further. And I'm not necessarily against that concept. I just think it needs a lot more testimony and work to for me to reach that expansion.
Any further discussion?
I think I've already said mine, Mr. Chair, but I do hope that Senator Brown knows I could have supported the bill. And I, again, salute her work and effort in this, but I don't agree with this one. Amendment.
Okay. We have motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 597 as amended by the Dash 3 and do pass recommendation. We did have a motion to that effect, didn't we?
If we didn't, I make it.
Okay, very good. Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 597 as amended by the Dash 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Hammond.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rosen.
Aye. Senate Bill 597, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And because of its connection to the dependency issue, Representative Krieger, would you be willing to carry this?
I'll find a way.
Very good. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 597 and open a work session on Senate Bill 298A. Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 298A relates to DUIs and the suspension, permanent revocation of licenses, I should say. It was before the committee on May the 9th and then again now on May 17th. ORS 809.235 provides for the permanent revocation of driving privileges for certain persons convicted of DUI. In relevant part, the statute applies to persons convicted of felony DUI or to persons convicted of misdemeanor DUI for a third or subsequent time. Not all DUIs involve motor vehicles. DUI statute prohibits driving a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants. Occasionally, the state prosecutes persons for operating non-motorized vehicles under the DUI statute. And we talked about this last time. The names for those can be PUIs, pedaling under the influence, buoys, biking under the influence, or boating under the influence. However, whether a person's on a bike, a boat, a car, there's only one conviction, and that conviction is for DUI, regardless if it's on a bike, boat, or a car. Senate Bill 298 provides that there is no permanent revocation of driving privileges if any one of the person's three prior convictions was for operating a non-motorized vehicle. So if one of your three was on a bike or in a canoe, it would not count. The burden of proving that a prior conviction was committed while operating a non-motorized vehicle falls on the defendant.
Committee, I brought this back to a work session because I wanted to get a discussion that we didn't have time for when this thing was up before. And I guess the question is, the policy question is, whether a person who is drunk and gets on a bicycle or into a canoe, whether that the sort of irresponsibility reflected in that conduct is such that when accumulated with any with times when they get behind the wheel of a car, which is conduct, I think, by general consensus we'd say is very serious misconduct, whether that conduct of getting on the bicycle or in the canoe, which generally puts at risk the person who's doing so, but not others, to the same degree, ought to count in the same way.
I agree to some degree, but that person on the bike may cause the vehicle operator to take an evasive action to endanger himself or others nearby to avoid improper operation of the bike or whatever it is he's on. That's just, you know, something we need to understand. And that goes back to the vulnerable driver thing we did the other day, where I jumped around the floor a little bit with good Representative Reed, was that all of the burden is being placed on the vehicle operator, that if he has done something wrong, he has to do take this course. And there's got to be some accountability for these people that are out there under the influence on any type of a vehicle.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Council Stanford. This doesn't change the fact that if somebody is pedaling under the influence or biking under the influence, that they can be prosecuted and fined and punished and penalized for riding or pedaling under the influence. Is that correct? And could we talk a little bit about what those consequences may be in Representative Krieger's situation where somebody's pedaling under the influence? What can they be charged with and what are the sanctions?
Representative Bonamici, I think thank you. It's an important point. This bill, to understand and debate this bill properly, the scope of this bill is about one thing and one thing only. It's about the permanent revocation of driving privileges. That's it. And so the bill talks about whether or not a person's license is permanently revoked. Right now, it's going to be permanently revoked if you have a felony DUI or if it's your third or subsequent misdemeanor DUI. Permanent revocation is one of a host of penalties that you get. The conviction is DUI. Again, whether it's on a bike, whether it's in a boat, whatever, we talk about PUIs, buoys, that's all just kind of silly language. It's a DUI. That's the only thing anybody's ever convicted of, is DUI. And if this bill were to pass, you're still convicted of DUI. You are still going to be general DUI sentence, at least in Multnomah County, is 2 years of what we call enhanced bench probation, alcohol treatment, at what's called the alcohol drug evaluation treatment, alcohol package, DUI conditions. There are all these other conditions. You are also going to have your license suspended. The license suspension is, well, right now there's a license suspension of, if you have your first DUI, it's a year. Second DUI, it's 3 years. And then the third brings in the permanent revocation. So this bill is solely saying there's no permanent revocation if you pick up your third, if one of your prior DUIs was not involving a motorized vehicle. You're still going to have to face the three-year revocation.
So let's say that I want to try a hypothetical, although that's sometimes risky. Let's say there's somebody who maybe is an older college student and says, okay, I've had a few beers. I'm always going to ride my bike home when I have a beer instead of driving. And they get three different buoys or whatever you call them. Could they have their license permanently revoked even though they made the conscious decision not to drive a car when they were drinking? Instead to ride a bike.
Under existing law, yes. All three of theirs. The first one, first DUI is a bicycle. Second DUI, and that would result in a one-year suspension. Second DUI, three-year suspension. Third, permanent. And even if every one of them was on a bicycle, yes.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, a bicycle rider who has never had a driver's license and has a third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Other than the penalty of dollars and cents in treatment, nothing.
Representative Krieger, my only basis for that, for responding, is what I've seen in Multnomah County. And it's 2 years of enhanced bench probation. Generally, on your first DUI, we're talking about, there's a statutory minimum of 2 days jail. And there's some exceptions to that. But it would be usually 10 days on the first DUI, 10 days custody, maybe 30 on the second, get up to 90, 120 on the third, but that's just Multnomah County.
What I'm getting at, your follow-up, is because they don't need a license to operate a bike, you can't suspend the right to ride a bike. So you could have the fourth or fifth, unless there's something the judge would do underneath an agreement of some type. So they never had a license to start with, but they could continue to operate the bike, unlike a motor vehicle operator.
Representative Krieger, the only thing that I could... correct, because you don't have to have a license. There are judges who will say one of your conditions of probation, given the problems, is stay off your bike. And that will happen. That's not built into the statutes or anything. That would just be the judge thing.
Representative Barker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably everybody in the room, if they drink and if they drive a car, at some time have done that together. And the law allows the diversion for your first drunk driving because I think we recognize in this society, in our culture, alcohol is just kind of one of the lubricants of life. This is for the people, third time. If you have three convictions of DUI for whatever you're on, you're an alcoholic, and you need to be off the road. And that's kind of what's behind this. I will grant a courtesy vote if one's needed today to move this out, but I support the law as it is. I think governor's task force on drunk driving has, you know, considered this quite a bit before they ran it forward.
And I would say, and thank you for the offer, the courtesy vote. This is one of those issues where I think we just kind of get a sense, and if there's not a sufficient consensus behind, you know, in this committee behind the bill, I think we don't move it out to the floor, would be my sense. Representative Cameron.
Well, I had an interesting conversation with a constituent that I slept with last night.
How often do you do that?
My wife.
He's bringing new meaning to serving the people.
And you know, she said, "Well, yeah, life, you know, on a bicycle, and you lose your license for life." She goes, "What if the person, you know, is in college and did it two or three times on their bicycle, and later on didn't have a drink again, and how do they go back and prove that they've been clean and sober and don't touch alcohol and get their license back?" And I thought, that's a good question. I don't know. And so I don't know if there's a way to look at the issue of, you know, it was a bicycle, it wasn't a car. And I think the decision of teaching our children not to, if you're going to be at Oregon State and you're going to be partying, don't get in your car, well, we don't tell them not to get on their bicycles, and that's the way they get around, and they get a DUI or a couple of them. It is different. So I think it is. I was pretty black and white on the issue before last night.
I'm not going to touch that one.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would ask our law enforcement experts on the committee, but I think the comments about riding the bike from college and things like that, if you're on the public road, you are endangering other people.
And yourself.
And we're concerned about behavior here. You know, if someone's on a bike on a public road and they're not in the bike lane,
flat.
Yeah, I mean, you could call someone else. This is so. I think it's behavior that we're looking after here, and that's the concern in how it affects society. I mean, if someone wants to get, you know, drunk at college, I've never done that, but.
Wait a minute, we might be able to inform our discussion a little bit with Sergeant Plummer. Sergeant, if you had some thoughts that would be helpful to share with the committee, and while he's coming forward, I want to note that Council Stanford and I spent a very enjoyable evening with Sergeant Plummer getting hammered a few weeks ago within the wet lab that DPSST operates, just to find out, you know, how, you know, what the experience of becoming inebriated and then driven to a place to sleep it off is like, which was a very helpful experience to me.
Thank you, Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Sergeant Plummer of the State Police. My primary responsibility at the Patrol Services Division is impaired driving programs. And to address Representative Cameron's question, The statute about permanent revocation, 09-235, that council read, has a provision in it that even though it says permanent revocation, there's a subsection that says that after 10 years, the person can apply to the court to have their driver's license reinstated. So even if they have that scenario that you outlined, there is a time period where the court recognizes that perhaps that has happened, or the statute recognizes that they've got cleanness over, they're good to go, and they can go back and apply to the court to have their driving privileges reinstated. So I hope that...
Okay, that helps.
I'll tell my constituent.
There you go.
Well, with that input and what I sense around the committee, that this is probably not a proposal that ought to go out to the House floor. I'm not seeing that in the committee. So, Sergeant, thank you very much.
Thank you,
for
sir, members of
sharing that with us. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 298 and open the work session on Senate Bill 288. Counselor.
Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 288A comes to you from the request of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. We've had this bill before us yesterday. Removes the requirement for parole hearings for someone sentenced to life imprisonment pursuant to ORS 163-105 to 163-115 must be conducted as a contested case hearing. Applies to hearings conducted on or after the effective date of the Act, unless A, the petitioner has petitioned the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision prior to the effective date of this Act, B, the prisoner was eligible for hearing at the time the petition was filed, and C, the prisoner was not granted a hearing on the petition that was filed prior to the effective date of this Act. Effective upon passage, Steve Powers is here, as is Becky Duncan. You may remember the discussion from yesterday.
Mr. Chair, we could. I got a letter from a convicted murderer complaining about this, and I hand it over. Maybe we could speak to the issues that the prisoner...
Should we bring Mr. Powers and Ms. Duncan? Why don't you both come up and help us kind of re-engage this issue, which we heard about.
Essentially, the prisoner is saying that if this is taken away, he'll lose some rights, and I'm not sure that's true until I ask Mr. Powers to take a look at the letter.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Representative Barker, I did read the letter, and as I see it, there were three issues that Mr. Janowski, who is a convicted aggravated murderer, I believe it's aggravated murder, brought up. One of the issues had to do with the retroactivity. The Section 3 of Senate Bill 288A addresses that, as Council Taylor just explained. So people are in the pipeline. Will get their contested case hearing if they are eligible, have petitions. They will get their one contested case hearing. What this bill does is, from that point forward, that the procedures that the board will use will be harmonized. And we're looking at a few hundred aggravated, 672 was my last count of people convicted of aggravated murder and murder, who eventually will get murder review hearings after they have served the mandatory minimum period of time. The second concern that the constituent raised was about the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Again, as Ms. Duncan testified to yesterday, the contested case proceedings are designed for many different administrative hearings. What this bill does is harmonize the proceedings that the board uses, because the board has been exempt from those contested case proceedings when the exemption was placed in the Administrative Procedures Act. The board believes that that's proper. There are there was a recent amendment in the 90s to ORS 144-335 that talked about the findings of fact and conclusions of law that the board needs to provide, and specified, and actually in reaction to a Supreme Court decision, that they need not be in any special form. And so it's, again, not placing this broad administrative procedures to one of the board's hearings. This is an attempt to harmonize those proceedings so that all of the board's hearings are proper. And as I mentioned yesterday in my testimony, those hearings have passed constitutional muster and procedural muster, and we believe that the exempting also this category, the murder review hearings, from the contested case procedures generally is good policy. Finally, the other issue brought up in the constituent letter is what happens after you're found capable of rehabilitation. Mr. Janowski, I was able to find out that he was found capable of rehabilitation and is moving on in the process. This is just a one step in the process to an aggravated murder or murderer being released on parole. If the board finds after this hearing that they are capable of rehabilitation, they go into what's the exit interview cycle, and then they have the board has a psychological evaluation as well as their conduct in the institution, and then makes has a separate hearing after that. After they've served the minimum, and then there's an actual release hearing in there. His complaint, as I understand it, is that he believes he's entitled to immediate release. That's currently being litigated, but I would point out on page 3 of Senate Bill 288A, lines 31 and 32, it specifies what happens after a capable of rehabilitation finding is made, and it specifies in statute that you are entitled to having the terms of your sentence be with the possibility of parole, not that you will be paroled, but that you have the possibility of parole. And so those are the concerns that were raised in the letter. Again, the board believes that this should be moved on to the full House for a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Powers, as I recall with the testimony on this bill from Ms. Duncan yesterday, and she can chime in if I'm misstating it, parole proceedings for those convicted of murder involve a burden of proof that the inmate needs to carry that is different from other settings, and that as a result of that burden of proof, that the procedural rights that are involved in a contested case hearing are more appropriate. Look to Ms. Duncan. Did I accurately capture that?
That's correct. As a matter of existing law, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rebecca Duncan with the Office of Public Defense Services, the Senate Bill 288 includes the existing law, which specifically provides that the burden of proving the possibility of rehabilitation is on the offender.
What comments do you have on that point?
Two comments, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. One, we don't believe that the Administrative Procedures Act provide any, does not materially enhance the due process rights of the offender in this type of hearing. As I explained before, the notice, the comment rights are specified in terms of our chapter 144, or in chapter 163, as you see in the bill, the right to an attorney. Those provisions, all those due process provisions are contained in other sections, and tagging us along with or locking us these hearings with the Administrative Procedures Act doesn't materially enhance the due process provisions. The second point is, while it is true that the offender does have the burden of proof to prove that they're capable of presently capable of rehabilitation. At the other hearings, while the board has to make an affirmative finding to deny re-release or to defer a projected parole release date in our exit interviews or in our parole consideration hearings, there is a burden on there. It's not specified in statute, but that the offender has to show that they have been rehabilitated, that they have an understanding of their crime, that they have an adequate parole plan. ORS 144-125 talks about or specifies that the board can defer a projected parole release date if the offender hasn't demonstrated an adequate parole plan, that they know where they're going to live, that they're going to be employed or go to school, those type of things. And so while it's not specified in statute like it is in Chapter 163 that they have the burden, there is a burden on the offender in those other hearings to demonstrate that they're ready to successfully transition to the community. And so given that in the board's view, APA doesn't materially enhance due process rights, and that they do have a burden in some of the other hearings, it's not as explicit as it is in 163, but they do have a burden of demonstrating that they're ready to successfully transition to the community. That would be the board's response to those concerns.
Council Taylor?
Mr. Powers, so in these kind of proceedings where it's murder, the prisoner has the burden of proof. The APA gives them greater discovery rights, ability to meet that burden through discovery processes they wouldn't otherwise have. Is that correct?
There are specific provisions that allow them for subpoena and cross-examination. That's not all that different from how the board currently holds its exit interviews and allows offenders to bring forth whatever evidence they have. Additionally, as I mentioned in my testimony yesterday, for our future disposition hearings, those are hearings that where an offender's out of custody, has violated their conditions of parole or post-prison supervision, and are now facing return to the community. We have a rule that allows for them to call witnesses and work through a subpoena process through the board. As I mentioned, and as this proceeded through the Senate side, the board is committed to working to importing that rule for the future disposition hearing to this type of rule, to these type of hearings as well. We can't do that, obviously, now because a rule can't trump a statute. But so to answer your question, this gives statutory rights for discovery that is different than the other hearings. That's true.
One fair question. So, Mr. Powers, you're saying that through your regulations, you will give them, they have the same rights in a non-murder case that they would have through the APA?
They have essentially the same rights. It's not statutory driven in terms of a subpoena that that is going out. We have a little different procedure for that. The subpoenas have to come through the board for future disposition hearings, or it has to be reviewed by the hearings officer. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, if they're represented by an attorney, subpoenas don't have to go through the board, and that's one of the concerns in terms of re-victimization and getting off track. It's true that someone might be able to bring that subpoena to the board, but again, that you can't unring a bell and going through all of that legal procedure for something in the board's view that doesn't materially enhance the offender's due process rights. Is unnecessary, and that's why we're advocating for this bill.
So your concern is the subpoenas issued by the attorney. Now, yesterday, Ms. Duncan talked about the fact that if an attorney abused that process, they would be subject to bar discipline. Is that correct?
It's possible. I mean, we've heard. I believe it is possible that they would be subject to bar discipline, but reading the bar disciplinary reports, you know, something that as an abuse of a subpoena, it has not risen to the level of at least the Supreme Court discipline as I've read the reports, but there might be a lower level discipline that they may be subject to.
Any further questions for either?
Can Mrs. Duncan comment on that?
Okay, so
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about this. It appears that the board is saying that they already comply, that they're already doing everything, so there's no need to keep these current requirements that they comply with the APA. If they are already complying with the APA, then there's no need for this bill, and there's no need to carve any to eliminate these basic procedural requirements, which, like I mentioned yesterday, they do apply in all sorts of hearings for all sorts of agencies, the medical examiner's board, the dental examiner's board, DMV. If you are to have an action, a contested case before the Department of Motor Vehicles, these APA requirements apply, and they are basic. It's like notice, and what's most important here is that it's the opportunity to call witnesses and to cross-examine witnesses who give adverse testimony to you. As we've been talking about today, in these cases, the offender bears the burden of proof in these hearings. They have to establish that they are capable of rehabilitation within a reasonable period of time. And in any other hearing in another agency where you have the offender bearing the burden of proof, it is appropriate for the offender to have the APA means for meeting that burden of proof, which would include simply calling witnesses and cross-examining those who testify against you. And there appears to be no need to eliminate these existing requirements. So we would encourage the committee to leave the requirements in place. And I'd also point out that findings of fact and conclusions of law are things that are required by the APA that would not be required if this bill passes. And when you think about not just the people who are appearing at these hearings, but what's happening in these hearings is that an existing sentence of life without parole is being converted. You have a three-person agency that's going to make this conversion, which is like a resentencing, and we think that minimal procedural protections for what's essentially a resentencing are appropriate not just for the individual offender, but for the public at large. If you're going to have a sentence converted like this one will be converted, I think you would want your agency to follow the same sorts of procedural requirements that the DMV would follow in another contested case proceeding. These are basic. We don't believe they're onerous. The Court of Appeals has interpreted the language of this to say that this is what the board is supposed to be doing. Apparently the board says we basically do this anyhow, so let's leave the requirements in place so that the board, when they're making these decisions, follows the basic procedures that other agencies do.
Mr. Powers, what is it that you accomplish by if we pass this bill? That is, if you're generally following the requirements of the APA in your murder parole hearings, then what is it that would be better about your operation if we pass this?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, it's about streamlining and harmonizing the board's procedures. If I may use a visual, the old Venn diagrams in terms of where there's overlap in terms of the board's hearings procedure, as we understand it with the exemption to the APA and the APA, they overlap quite a lot in terms of notice, in terms of coming forth and the offender having the opportunity or having the burden to make their case. There are some outlying areas. That's the issuance of subpoenas. That's the findings of fact. Where the board believes that the due process rights are core or central, the board believes that our current policy of in our other hearings overlaps the APA. But these outlying areas and the APA being something for other administrative agencies, the board is an administrative agency, but it has been treated very differently. We have, Chapter 144 and have specific requirements that have tailored to what the board does. Attaching the APA as just this larger procedural mechanism, in the board's view, doesn't make sense and is a clunky mechanism for how the board operates its business. For the other nine hearings, the procedures have been working in the core essential due process rights, but it's these outlying areas that the passage of Senate Bill 288A helps streamline and harmonize the board's procedures.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really tough for me because when I heard Mr. Powers, I thought, well, of course, this makes sense. And then I heard Ms. Duncan, I thought, well, maybe it doesn't make so much sense. And the thing that concerns me primarily is the revictimization. And I think I'd feel a little bit more comfortable if either of you addressed how that could be prevented, other than the practical aspect. And I found an email from Mrs. Janowski who says, I don't know if the rest of you have this, that I know the victim's family members attend parole hearings regularly, but I can say that none of the offenders are going to subpoena them. The whole point of the hearing is to receive a finding capable of rehabilitation so that they can be released from prison. They only want to call people who have a positive comment to make on their behalf.
Sure.
But that's more of a practical issue. I think I'd feel a little more comfortable in this if I knew that there were some realistic ways to keep the re-victimization from happening. And the other point that I want to make is with regard to the findings of fact and conclusions of law, I think that would help the victims just as much as, if not more than, it would help the person requesting the hearing, because the victim's family has a right to know, well, what are the reasons? Why are they making this decision to either let the person go or to keep the person in? And I think that would be a very useful tool for the victim's family to have.
Counselor Taylor, was there a question that you wanted to respond to?
The re-victimization, what are the protections to the victim's family?
Okay.
Representative Bonamici, Mr. Chair, if I may. There's, like the email you have points out, the practical consideration that the inmates are unlikely to call the victims. There are a couple things which I mentioned yesterday, one of which is if the offender is appearing pro se representing himself, the subpoenas have to go through the board. And so if someone seeks to subpoena a victim's family member, the board can not even issue that subpoena. So it's never going to come in the mail. They're never going to receive it. If the offender has an attorney, then the attorney is the one who would issue the subpoena, and then you would have all of the checks that you have throughout the legal system on attorneys issuing subpoenas when they're not appropriate, ethical. The bar complaints could be filed, that sort of thing. And you're just relying on the attorneys as officers of the court to not abuse the subpoena process. Also, if an attorney were representing an inmate in these cases and that inmate was indigent, that attorney would be being paid by the state. And if they were abusing the subpoena process in any way, I imagine that their ability to continue to contract with the state would be compromised. So there's all sorts of checks that would keep the inmates from subpoenaing the victim's family. And that said, I mean, the scope of these hearings, as it's set out in the statute, is only about the rehabilitation. So there is no, like the email says, there's no reason why these people would be called. All of that said, we would not oppose any sort of amendment that says the victim's family can appear at this hearing and make a statement about the effect of converting the sentence, what that would be on them, and that the inmate is not allowed to cross-examine that person. That's fine.
Committee, we're about to run out of time. We're due on the floor at 10 a.m., and this is obviously a complicated issue, maybe not an issue that rises in importance as much as it does in complexity. We could bring it back to further discussion. Maybe we could take it offline and people could express their views about it and decide whether it should come back to work session. Maybe an indication of where people's thinking is going might be helpful.
Like, as usual, Representative Bonamici and I agree, this is a complicated issue. And both of them, I appreciate. I apologize for not being here. Yes, it's interesting. I was participating in the classroom law project. Eighth graders were discussing due process. So I did get some background. And I would like to maybe think or have the chair, where are you on this as far as, I think they both make good presentations. And as Representative Bonamici said, I thought I was for both of them, but you can't be for both of them.
Right. We think we are out of time, and I am. I said that the chair has not clearly decided on this issue himself. So I think we're going to close the work session. We'll roll the remaining continuation of this work session over to tomorrow's meeting. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 288, and close the House Judiciary Committee for Thursday the 17th.